all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hey, welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, a CW-2 helicopter type pilot, 1969 in Vietnam. I want to welcome you to our program today. I'm very excited. Our guest is going to be Andrew Dubbins, and he's written a book called Into Enemy Waters. And this is all about underwater demolition teams. For those of you that are my age, you can go back and start thinking Sea Hunt, you know, those types of things. So it's a kind of an unknown unit until recently. And these are the guys that would go into the beaches before the invasions and try to take out, you know, whatever the bad guys had put down there to prevent the landing craft from getting on the beaches. And so before we get into that, just want you to think about, you know, some of those relatives that you may have deep back in the background that might have been involved, especially during World War II, when this was kind of all new type of science, new types of warfare and so forth. And, you know, maybe you have some out there that might be interested in this story. Before we get into that, I need to really thank our sponsors, because obviously we can't do this program without them. And that starts off with our Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans, they specialize in veteran disability claims. So give them a call at 800-693-4800. Or you can find out more information at their website. That's legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, you can go to their website. That's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information about what's going on over at the VA here in Ann Arbor, you can go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. The Veterans Lending Council. This is where you can learn everything that you need to know about a veteran's loan or home loan or anything else that has to do with mortgages. And you can learn, as I mentioned, all about that. They are on Facebook. It's called the Veterans Lending Council. And they hold seminars for not only for realtors, but also for veterans who are thinking about, you know, financing their home through a veterans VA loan. Great guys, great information, something I think you might really want to check out. And also we want to thank our local veteran service organizations. That includes the American Legion Post 46 here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the Vietnam Veterans of America, that's Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310, and the DFW Post 423 Hall here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Without your support, we can't do this program, and we really want to thank them for that continuing support. If you'd like to get involved with Veterans Radio and support us, you can just go to our website. That's veteransradio.net. All the information is there. And here's a quick segue. We're going to be doing our first fundraiser. Now, you all know that Veterans Radio has been on the air for 19 years now, and we've been kind of, you know, struggling along as we go, and a lot of buddy money, a lot of buddy assistance going on as we're raising funds to be on the program, to sponsor the program. So, as you know, possibly you know, 2 years ago, we formed a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, Veterans Radio America. And we do business as Veterans Radio. But we're going to have our first fundraiser. And coming up on Sunday, September 25th, which is normally one of our benefits programs, it's going to be that again. But we're going to do some radio on the river, as we're calling it here locally. And so Sunday, September 25th, from 2 to 5 p.m., we are going to be having guest speakers and so forth at a undisclosed location. You got to buy a ticket to find out where it's going to be held. And so it's going to be kind of fun. We're going to have a number of people there a little earlier, Marines, Navy, Army, World War II, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Korea. We're going to be telling stories, all kinds of different things to generate some funding for the program. So if you want more information about Radio on the River, just go to, again, to our website, veteransradio.net. We've got a big banner ad right there. Just click on that, and it will take you to find more information about what's going on. And we are going to be doing our program live from Radio on the River that Sunday. So it'll be kind of an adventure. We're going to be outdoors, and we're hoping that here, you know, we are here in Michigan, so it might start snowing. You never know. But check it out. We really would appreciate if you come out for Radio on the River. All right. Take care of all the unofficial business. Right? Slide that over. All right. So here we go. The book that I received was Into Enemy Waters, and it's about it's a World War II story of the demolition divers who became Navy SEALs. The author is Andrew Dubbins, and Andrew is a well-known author. He hadn't really gotten into World War II stuff, but he's written a lot of different things. And so I want to welcome him to our program. So, Andrew, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Dale.
It's my pleasure. This is, we've been doing a series of seems like a series of programs about World War II in the Pacific recently. And this just really got my attention. Our audience knows that my dad was in the Coast Guard during World War II, and he was involved in the invasions of Iwo Jima and Okinawa. So as I'm reading through the other books and reading yours again, I'm finding out more and more, since as a typical World War II veteran, he never talked about his experiences. And so I just wanted to let our audience know that this stuff that's in here, I think, is really great. And so my first question is going to be, you know, what motivated you to write this story about these underwater demolition teams?
Well, it all started on a visit to the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, which is a fantastic museum. I recommend it to anyone with just a passing interest in World War II. And I was walking through an exhibit on the Pacific Theater, and I saw a swim fin behind the glass display case and surrounded by weapons and ammunition that was out of place, such a low-tech piece of equipment. Read the description and saw that it belonged to a member of the underwater demolition teams. And I consider myself a student of World War II, had never heard of the UDTs, jotted it down. And when it came time to write a book, I decided that's a topic I'd really like to dive into for 2 years, and just was fascinated learning more about these unsung heroes of World War II.
So the book follows a story of George Morgan, who was 17 years old when he joined the Navy. He's from New Jersey, just for our audiences again. Lakehurst, Hindenburg, all those things. And how did you get in touch with George?
It was hard. It's a very generic name. When you're a journalist, you hope for a more unique name, but there are a lot of George Morgans out there. But I was able to track him down in Arizona, and it was at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, so a lot of our interviewing was over the phone, but I did have the opportunity to meet him in person, and so generous with his time and just typical of the greatest generation, humble. He could never really understand what I saw in his story. You know, he said, I'm just one of millions of fellas who did what they had to do in World War II, and here I was hanging on his every word, like you mentioned. I'm a history buff, so hearing his stories about seeing an early prototype of the television broadcasting out of Patterson, or seeing the Hindenburg go over on the day it crashed, was just fascinating for me.
I can only imagine. That was a great section of the story when you were talking about George's growing up in New Jersey, and those that are listening out there, he was just coming back from Seaside Heights, which is a big amusement area on the Jersey Shore, and spent many a time there myself. But so the idea was, the way the book is written is that you kind of give us the history of this underwater demolition unit, but there's a kind of a founding father of this whole thing, and that would be Draper Kaufman. And tell us a little bit more about him, because he's really an interesting character. I mean, he got involved in World War II before we were even in it.
Yeah, a fascinating character. His father was a admired admiral in Navy and followed his footsteps into Annapolis, but had terrible eyesight, prevented him getting a commission to command a destroyer, which was his dream, like his father, to command destroyers. So he went a different route and got into the shipping industry. Meanwhile, was watching developments in Germany, had the opportunity to see Hitler speak in person, traveled a lot in his shipping job, and decided something's happening over here. U.S. needs to get involved, and volunteered driving ambulances in France as the Germans were spilling into France, got captured by the Germans and released with a group of other ambulance drivers. And on the condition that he'd never take up arms against the Germans, violated that, went to the UK and volunteered on a bomb disposal team, defusing bombs. Did that for a year until finally the US Navy welcomed him back in despite his bad eyesight and tasked him to launch the first naval combat demolition school out of Fort Pierce, Florida, and is considered the father of the underwater demolition teams and the Navy SEALs. The SEALs still refer to him as the Grandpappy Bullfrog.
Yeah, that's true. This guy is really awesome. As you mentioned, his eyesight was terrible. He couldn't even get into the Navy originally, and just kind of followed along. And you mentioned that he was assigned. How did he get assigned to start up this unit? Was this his idea, or did somebody say, hey, let's start this underwater demolition team?
Well, it's interesting. His experience was in defusing bombs, but he had no experience in using demolition to destroy enemy obstacles. So it was brand new for him. And it was in preparation for the D-Day landings. That was the Navy's priority at the time. And somebody recommended him as a naval reserve officer who could think outside the box. And he was really the perfect fit, because creative, a little outside the establishment as a reserve. So he has a quote saying, I was allowed to break the rules and plead ignorance later, and translated over to the underwater demolition teams, where he's leading up the Maui experimental training base. And that's where they were just pioneering combat swimming, which had never been done in the U.S. There was an Italian dive team and some ancient examples, but brand new tactics, measuring the water depth with fishing line and deploying out of speeding landing crafts. So it was all learning on the fly.
Well, the reason that they wanted to start this thing, my understanding, is that some of their initial invasions in Africa and so forth, they kept running into these obstacles trying to get the landing craft onto the beaches. And so they were charged with going into the water and blowing up these obstacles. I mean, they would put, you know, there were mines in there, of course, and there were all these big giant steel things stuck into the sand and anything else that could disrupt the, you know, these really, I think the Higgins boats, some of them were plywood, you know, to get into the beaches. And it's just interesting how they finally came up with this idea. Well, you know, if we can get rid of these obstacles, then we can get our troops onto the beaches faster and so on and so forth. And so, let's go back to George for a minute. And so George is just this Jersey boy. He's 17 years old. Did he try to enlist, or did he get drafted?
He enlisted on his 17th birthday. He was caught up in the patriotic fervor, as so many young men his age, and joined the Navy because his dad had been in the Army and saw horrors during World War I, and he didn't want to relive those. And fortunately, as he told me, he did see a lot of difficult things during World War II that still haunt him to this day. He had a difficult time recounting some of these memories to me. I commend him for his courage in telling his story as much as in living through it. But volunteered for the Navy and went through basic up in upstate New York, deployed to Fort Pierce, Florida, where they were sorting the men and said, do you know how to swim? He said, sure, I was a lifeguard. And that got him into the UDTs. They put him in another line, and he became a, was actually at the time Naval Combat Demolition Units. Okay. And his first week of training was what the SEALs call Hell Week, really intense, rigorous conditioning course.
Yeah, because these were, I mean, not really muscular guys. They were just swimmers, basically. I mean, that was their strength, wasn't it?
Right. And George always joked about that because they were calling it Hell Week back in the 40s. That's where the term originated in Fort Pierce, Florida. And it was Draper Kaufman who condensed the Raiders training program into 1 week and running in the soft sand, wading through the mangrove swamps and ocean swims at night, carrying demolition on their backs. And George would always say, we're just a bunch of skinny kids. It's nothing like the SEALs do today. And to some extent, he's right. It's much more rigorous today and higher rate of attrition. But I always had to tell him, yeah, but George, you were the first. You guys were the pioneers.
That's true. I have a nephew who is an Army Ranger, but he was sent out to Coronado to work with the Navy SEALs. And I had the privilege of going out there one time and meeting a bunch of these guys, and every one of them looked like, I don't know, they were all Arnold Schwarzenegger type shape conditions, you know, and they all wanted to shake my hand and broke every bone in my hand and everything else. These were buff guys. I mean, I can't imagine comparing, and, you know, as George describes, you know, what did he say? I think he was only, you know, 170 pounds or something along those lines. And, you know, most of these guys today, you know, one arm is 170 pounds. But, yeah, I think the training is so much differently. The other thing I wanted to bring up about George is that he was a wannabe baseball player. And there are so many of these stories that we've had where we were able to talk to these men. Now, unfortunately, you know, they're passing away so quickly because they're in their 90s, but all of them had the same dreams as every 17-year-old kid had at the time. You know, they wanted to do this, they wanted to do that. And he actually almost made it to professional baseball. You mentioned in the book, Into Enemy Waters, is that he had a tryout with the Dodgers and was offered a contract.
Yeah. He was a pitcher, kind of grew up playing on the sandlots in New Jersey. And after he enlisted in the Navy, there was a bit of a waiting period, and he saw a tryout for the farm league, Brooklyn Dodgers, went on the tryout and actually got the job. Branch Rickey called him into the office and said, we want to hire you for our Elmira farm league team. Branch Rickey, a few years later, would sign Jackie Robinson famously, right, and was a pioneer in the farm leagues. And a couple days after that, signing the contract, his parents were thrilled. He was thrilled. It was his boyhood dream come true. He got called into the Navy. He said, shipping off. So I kept that theme going through the book, in that that was a sacrifice that he made, you know, and you think how many 17-year-olds would give up a big career and celebrity these days to do their patriotic duty like that. It's really, really something.
I agree. And when we think about, you know, all the other ballplayers that were in the service during World War II, that people would recognize the names of Joe DiMaggio and the Ted Williams and so forth, that, you know, gave up 4 years of their quote professional career just to fight for their country. And I think that that's really, really an important thing. We're talking here with Andrew Dubbins, and the book is Into Enemy Waters. It becomes available, I guess it's available now, but it's really kind of burst out, coming out on the 23rd of August. Is that correct?
That's right. Tuesday.
All right. That's going to be a good day for you.
Yes,
we're going to be selling a lot of books, I hope. And the interesting thing, one of the other interesting things about the books, is how you go from the stories that you've researched and so forth, and kind of go back to George, and he either, you know, he verifies what he's talking about, but it's just the same old thing. You say, well, I don't know, we weren't, you know, we're just doing what we were supposed to do, and you know, they're so humble. These men, you know, today, and, you know, when you think of it, it's 75 years ago that he was doing these things, and it's, you know, he says, well, I can't really remember, but it sounds like it's, yeah, he does remember.
It was, and some of these memories were, again, so difficult for him to recount, but vivid, and all, even all those years ago. And you're right, just so humble and always downplaying his role, and, you know, always turn the conversation back to his commander, Draper Kaufman, and all the incredible things he had done. I sometimes couldn't believe his humility.
Well, you know, if we kind of try to follow this chronologically, which I know, I realize I'm all over the place today, but so George Morgan, along with Draper, they're down in Fort Pierce, Florida. Their very first mission is Normandy and D-Day, right?
Draper went off to the Pacific to prepare for Saipan. George had just graduated and was sent over with all the men from Fort Pierce as last-minute additions to Operation Overlord. It was his first experience in combat. I write about in the book, just most of his memories are just being terrified. And picture 17-year-old, they're going in unarmed, a lot of times ahead of the landing forces, because the infantry who are supposed to give them cover landed in the wrong place. The amphibious tanks were floundering. So they were on Omaha Beach with only their demolition equipment, no rifles, doing really difficult technical work, and it resulted in tragic casualties. Meanwhile, Draper, 8 days later, was leading the first major daylight reconnaissance mission of the underwater demolition teams at Saipan, which all the men thought were going to be a suicide mission, swimming into an enemy beach, heavily fortified enemy beach in broad daylight. Draper couldn't believe it was going to be in broad daylight, even questioned the order when it was handed down to him. But because they were able to use the water as their refuge, bobbing heads made for difficult targets, it turned out not to be many casualties and was a huge success. And the reason that the Navy use the UDTs on every major invasion moving forward.
I can't even imagine the fear level. You know, I was listening to another interview that you did, and they were talking about the going ashore on Omaha Beach. You know, sort of like the Saving Private Ryan story. You know, and they're on the beach at the same time as the troops are landing on the beach, and they're supposed to be blowing up stuff so that the troops can get on the beach. And, you know, one of the guys, you know, you don't want to lean against this piling here because I'm going to blow it up on you here in a minute. And it's just, I can't imagine the adrenaline rush, of course, but the fear factor. I mean, as you mentioned, they are unarmed. They have a knife. That's it. I mean, and they're carrying explosives. And they're carrying prime cord, and, you know, we'll get into that in a little while, how they, you know, some of the things that they came up to, how to keep this stuff waterproof. But, you know, there are boats, there are bodies, there are stuff getting blown up all around them, and they just keep doing their mission. I just, you know, this is just amazing to me.
It's amazing. And I do give some credit to, even though he wasn't there, Draper Kaufman and his Hell Week training so that men could operate under the most trying conditions without adequate food, terrified and sleepless nights. And it gave them that mental fortitude, to be able to do that. And you think, I mean, the work of demolition is high stakes, difficult, mentally fatiguing work. They're not looking up on the bluffs and able to try to avoid enemy fire. They're focused on their work. And that's why the casualties were so high. And they were successful. It took them the whole day, but they were able to clear their gaps and get our tanks ashore and help turn the tide of the battle.
I think that's interesting. We're going to take a real quick break here just to let Derek note that we're going to be doing that. But I want to talk a little bit about the fortifications at on D-Day, about the way the Germans thought that they were going to fight it. And then we can go to Iwo Jima and Okinawa and talk about how the Japanese fortified their beaches. Right? All right. Sure. So we are talking with Andrew Dubbins, it's D-U-B-B-I-N-S, And the book is Into Enemy Waters. It's a story of the underwater demolition teams first adventures, their first incursions into foreign waters. So stick around. We've got more coming up on this interview. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Lieutenant J.G. William Hall pressed the attack, although seriously wounded during the Battle of the Coral Sea. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Hall was the pilot of a scouting plane in action against enemy Japanese forces in the Coral Sea. In a determined attack on 7th of May, 1942, Hall dove his plane at an enemy Japanese aircraft carrier, contributing materially to the destruction of that vessel. On the 8th of May, facing heavy and fierce fighter opposition, he again displayed extraordinary skill as an airman and the aggressive spirit of a fighter in repeated and effective counterattacks against the superior number of enemy planes, in which three enemy aircraft were destroyed. Though seriously wounded in this engagement, Hall succeeded in landing his plane safe.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net. VeteransCrisisLine.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
We're back here on Veterans Radio. We're talking with Andrew Dubbins, and his book is called Into Enemy Waters, and it's a story of the underwater demolition teams that were formed during World War II, kind of out of thin air. It sounds like when they decided that they needed to figure out a way to get these troops onto the beaches. And in the first part, we were just talking about D-Day and how, we know that Rommel, the well-known general in the German army, had fortified the beaches of Normandy. And he had decided that, that they were going to meet the enemy right at the edge of the water. That was my understanding from your book. Is that correct?
That's right. And some of his generals, officers beneath him, thought that was the wrong idea. They wanted to move further inland and try to repel the attack from inland and drive the U.S. back across the English Channel. Rommel took him down to the water's edge and said, no, this is where the battle is going to be won or lost. And it led to 500,000 obstacles being built along the Normandy coast, the most formidable beach blockade ever devised, and fell to these young naval combat demolition unit men to clear gaps to allow our amphibious tanks and vehicles to get through the barricade.
We have this picture today of our Navy SEALs, and they've got all kinds of equipment and they've got all kinds of suits and gear and so forth. Could you kind of describe what our fearless underwater demolition team members, including George Morgan, what was their uniform of the day?
At Normandy, and this would change for the UDTs, but at Normandy, they were wearing khaki shirts, dungarees, so they had a uniform and no rifle. Did have a knife for cutting fuses and detonation cord. They had packs of Tetratol, which is like TNT, and they had long fuse lines called Primacord, which burn at a very high rate. So it was a matter of attaching those packs of Tetratol to the German obstacles, running the Primacord line between them and blowing up the obstacles in a big blast. At Omaha Beach, under this heavy enemy fire, we had our own tanks were ripping Primacord lines. You had shell bursts, sometimes blowing up entire stocks of the tetratol packs, which resulted in heavy casualties. So it was a real cauldron of enemy fire.
How close did the underwater demo teams get to the beach before they went into the water?
So the NCBUs in that case, they were coming right up onto the beach in most cases. There were landing crafts that got stranded further out and had to wade ashore at, you know, low tide. Underwater demolition teams over in the Pacific, they were dropping outside the reef in most cases and swimming ashore up to the dune line was their responsibility. They weren't going past the dunes and measuring the underwater beach approaches using fishing line, as I mentioned. And so they were in different uniform than the NCDUs. They were in swim trunks, dive mask, swim fins. They had a little plexiglass slate tied to their leg or around their neck for scribbling the depth measurements. And then they had a weighted reel of fishing line, drop fishing line to take the measurements. So very minimalist uniform.
I would think my point I was trying to make here was, you know, they're jumping into these waters, especially in on Omaha Beach in D-Days. That water's got to be cold. And they did not have, the diving, you know, suits that we're familiar with, today. So they got to be losing so much energy, you know, through just trying to stay warm.
Yeah. And that's one thing George would always mention. I mean, you come into the reporting with a little bit of a glamorized image of these underwater warriors, but it was always just how cold the water was. And they would come up with different ways to try to warm up. They'd wear long johns. And George said, sometimes we tried putting grease over the long johns. And it occurred to me, it sounds like an early homemade wetsuit. Wetsuit wouldn't be developed until the 50s. So they were trying this stuff out. And he said that slowed you down a little in the water when the long johns absorb the water, but it was worth it for the extra little bit of warmth. But yeah, freezing ocean temperatures. Maui was, and especially when they were training at Maui and used to the warmer waters when they deployed to Iwo Jima and Okinawa, it was 60s.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, we used to have contests when we were growing up, and, you know, at the end of June, even in New Jersey, you know, jumping into the water that was not warm yet. You know, you'd go into the water and come out almost before you hit the water because it was so cold. And these guys are swimming out there for long periods of time, many cases.
Yeah. And it created some issues with cramps. You know, they would swim in buddy pairs, which the seals do to this day, swim buddies. And George said, sometimes I'd have to stop in the water. My buddy would have to help me massage out a cramp. You also had some ear infections and coming back from heavy exertion in cold water. They also had to deal with the shallow coral reef, you know, when a wave is taking you up and down on a reef and you scratch yourself. Sometimes there's poison on the coral. And so doctors would have to look that over. So there were injuries. I mean, they were at risk from all directions. You think the Japanese firing on them, and then there's sharks and there's ocean, cold ocean, and it was hard work.
I'm dumbfounded by thinking about how long these guys would spend in the water, and then with all of the nice little creatures that seem to wander around in oceans on a fairly regular basis, I just don't get it. All right, so from D-Day, now we're going across the Pacific. He's in Hawaii. We're talking about George Morgan here, getting more additional training that Draper Kaufman has dreamed up for these guys to survive in Hawaii. And then they go off to where would George went to Iwo Jima next, correct?
Right. And they were aboard an old APD, a fast destroyer, and four landing craft on the deck. And they pull up days ahead of the Marines and climb into those landing craft. George told me they'd always start the engine the propeller would be spinning in the air because they wanted to just get the water going. And that was a big factor in their tactics, is the landing craft made for easier targets for the Japanese. So the swimmers were all eager to get in the ocean because they could dive underneath enemy bullets. They found that machine gun bullets slowed down a few feet below the ocean surface. So they were taught to hold their breath for long stretches of time. So the water was really their refuge. And then the pickup at Saipan, the boats were slowing down and drawing really heavy enemy fire. So they devised a method where all the men would line up in the water and they'd have a rubber raft tied to the landing craft. And the landing craft would go zooming down the line of men, and there'd be two UDT guys in the rubber raft, one with a steel cord rope, and each man would hook his arm through the rope ring, and the momentum of the boat would tug them out of the water, and a second guy called the catcher would drag them in. So they were able to get in and out of the water at high speeds, which reduced their risk of coming under enemy fire.
I feel we dislocated shoulders, probably.
You would think. Yeah.
I would think a lot. So into techniques now. Again, we talked about the Germans. You know, Rommel said, we're going to meet the enemy on the beach. This is, we're going to stop them right here. Well, Iwo Jima, that wasn't the case. The general on Iwo Jima decided that we're going to let these Marines get on the island, and then we're going to hopefully get rid of them.
At Iwo Jima, the tactic was not to open fire until the American landing wave. Unfortunately, the gunboats, which were supposed to provide covering fire for the swimmers while they were in the water, which is another big part of the UDT story, are these fire support ships. You'd have a line of destroyers behind them and gunboats and battleships lobbing shells onto the beach to keep the Japanese pinned down during the swim operations. And the gunboats, as they approached the beach, it was the same silhouette as an infantry landing craft. It had been adapted from the European theater in the Pacific and retrofitted with guns. So the Japanese, although they had been holding fire, thought that our Marines were coming ashore, and they opened fire with the full brunt of their beach defenses. And the gunboats, it's a famous gunboat battle of World War II, took a pounding. You know, the swimmers had to dive underneath all this ordnance and was a successful scouting mission that enabled the landing of our Marines.
Say, there's a lot of courage going on here. I mean, you know, everybody is just scared to death, and that they're just able to suck it up and to, you know, get on with their mission.
I always think about that too. I mean, in your teens, pulling up to these islands where you know the enemy are there waiting, and to be the first one unarmed going into the water to scout the terrain, it's just another level of courage. And I remember George saying he's, in addition to the reconnaissance they collected and clearing the obstacles, he thinks it really gave a confidence boost to the Marines knowing that somebody had been there first, that they weren't going in blind. And I agree.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, they were, yeah. Well, they're probably going, well, you guys are in your bathing, you know, in your bathing suit and your flippers. If you can go on the beach, we sure can.
Right. Right.
I would hope. Anyhow, holy mackerel. So with Iwo Jima, they had to go in and they clear the areas for the ships and the boats and the landing craft and everything else. As you described it, I thought that was rather interesting. So if people can imagine in their minds that these gunboats basically are heading towards the shore, and behind them you have destroyers, and behind them you have, I don't know what they would, I'm not in the Navy, so it's, you know, I would think battleships, and, you know, and then even further out, of course, you've got, you know, your aircraft carriers and all the other stuff. And each one are lobbing bigger and bigger shells onto the beaches. And, you know, our guys are swimming up to the beaches and, you know, trying to blow up anything that they've got there to deter these landing craft from getting there. That was my biggest fear. My most frightening time period was coming under a mortar attack, and I didn't know where they were coming from, and I couldn't dig a hole deep enough. I mean, that's just what I felt like. I mean, and I was on asphalt, so it was really hard. But that was my biggest fear.
Yeah, and it's the fire support, which I write a lot about, got to be very effective by war's end, so much so that at Okinawa, the Japanese ceded the beaches to the U.S. I mean, I have the episode of Ernie Pyle landing with the Marines, and they were all expecting another huge firefight, and it was silent. They heard the birds chirping. Ernie Pyle has his lunch on the sand. And it was because of that American fire support. They didn't think they could hold the beach, so they moved inland and dug their tunnels, and it ended up, of course, being a huge, ferocious battle. But it was a testament to the UDTs and our amphibious capabilities at that point in the war that the Japanese weren't even putting up a fight on the shore.
Right. And our UDTs were learning with each landing that they were making, they were improving and changing, you know, their tactics as they went along.
Right. The first story, which is fascinating, they grew out of the Tarawa, the disaster at Tarawa, where our Marine landing boats got stranded on shallow coral reef at low tide. Marines had to wade half mile to shore under withering Japanese fire. And Kelly Turner, Admiral Kelly Turner, said, we need to deploy specialists ahead of the Marines to scout these beach approaches and destroy any coral reef or enemy barriers in the way. And their first deployment was at Kwajalein, a little atoll. And the plan was for them to be in uniform, just look over the side, the gunwales of their landing craft. But a couple guys wore swim trunks under their fatigues, and they said, we could probably get closer and scout the coral heads better by swimming. And so they stripped out of their uniforms and jumped in the water and came back, and Kelly Turner called him right to his command ship, and they gave the intel. So that was the first time that they got out of the boats and into the sea, and that was really the dawn of the UDTs.
You know, you got to go with what you know, and then you got to improvise. And every war plan, as soon as the battle begins, goes out the door. Or out the window, and you know, you're improvising the rest of the time period, and this is what they seem to do. And so we are talking with Andrew Dubbins. The book is Into Enemy Waters. It's about the underwater demolition teams and how they evolved during World War II. And some of the stories that you mentioned, Andrew, if my hair wasn't already white, it would turn white. Once they got to Okinawa, again, they're allowed to get on the beaches, as you mentioned. And, you know, the Japanese are determined to fight till the bitter end. I mean, they have agreements, or their orders are to take out 10 Americans before they die and so forth. And they're trying to preserve the entryway, I guess, to the main islands of Japan, because that's next. You know, if we can take Iwo Jima and then we can take Okinawa, the next goal is going to be the mainland of Japan. And in fact, you have a whole area in the story about these underwater demo guys on their ships, and you talk about the kamikazes. Could you go into that a little bit? Because that is just terrifying to me.
Right. So the strategy of the Japanese at Okinawa was to bleed the American forces so heavily that they would rethink an invasion of the Japanese home islands. And part of that strategy was to attack our Navy with these kamikaze aircraft. And as George recalls, looking up in the sky and seeing these planes, and usually they'd be firing back at our planes, but they were just making a beeline for our troop ships and crashing into them. And talk about terrifying for these underwater demolition teams. They have all their tetratol and explosives below decks. So one, you know, spark, they couldn't even light cigarettes on the ship. Had to be careful during refueling. And you think about a kamikaze loaded down with every bomb and fuel you can imagine. And fortunately, none hit a UDT transport that set off the explosives, but a lot of the destroyers that were escorting UDTs got hit. I read about one of Draper's friends from Annapolis, George Phillips, went down with his ship. So huge losses in the Navy, and that was really the Philippines were where the kamikaze had started, but at Okinawa was really the full brunt of it.
Yeah, my as I mentioned before, my dad was involved he was on an LST going to Okinawa from Iwo Jima, and their ship got hit by a kamikaze, and he ended up, you know, jumping into the Pacific Ocean and then going back onto the ship that caught fire. And we had official Navy photograph of his LST burning in the middle of the Pacific. And he never talked about it, which is understandable. But the what these men went through to try and get to Japan to end this war. And in fact, the UDTs were, once Okinawa was controlled, can't think of a different word. Their next mission was Japan. In fact, they were on their way.
That's right. Operation Olympic was going to be MacArthur's giant landing into the Japanese home islands, and the UDTs were a part of that. Draper Kaufman was planning it in Manila, and the reconnaissance we were collecting was that, unlike at Okinawa, where the Japanese had ceded the beaches, they were preparing a D-Day-like defense of their southern islands and blockading the beaches and stockpiling weapons and kamikaze aircraft, suicide boats, suicide torpedoes. They were preparing for all-out war, every man, woman, and child. The atomic bombs, of course, made that invasion unnecessary. But the UDT were still called upon to lead our occupation forces into the Japanese home islands in advance of the surrender ceremony. So they were the first naval forces to set foot on the Japanese home islands. One Japanese commander surrendered his samurai sword to a UDT officer, which could be seen as the first official surrender of Japanese troops. And MacArthur asked that the sword be given back because he wanted that honor.
Well, we know there are many, many stories about General MacArthur. We won't go into those today. One of the funny things I thought in your book about, you know, the island of, you know, going into the invasion of Japan was that the UDTs put up a sign that said, "Welcome to the Marines," and the UDTs were already there.
That was a habit of theirs, beginning at Guam, putting up those signs. And it was a friendly rivalry, and there was mutual love and respect between the UDTs and the Marines. So much so, there was one incident that Draper Kaufman, they were going to get hazard pay that submariners and parachuters get, and they'd been pre-approved for it. And Draper Kaufman invited a couple teams and said, "What do you guys think?" And they wrote a response that, "We don't want hazard pay until the Marines get it," because they'd seen them in action on Iwo Jima. So they turned it down. So the signs were all in good fun. But it does speak to this reputation that the UDT developed, and that Draper Kaufman acknowledged as kind of the problem children of the Navy. They were growing long beards. They were wearing swim trunks. They had no official shipboard duties. So while you had the Navy guys scrubbing the decks and cleaning the latrines, they were kind of walking around in their swim trunks and smoking cigarettes and killing time. But I asked George about this. I said, was there kind of a rebellious attitude? And he said, none at all. We were Navy men and respected our officers and were doing a job. So there was some of that, but, you know, not across the board.
Well, there are certain units that, you know, get an undeserved reputation sometimes for being a little lax. Yeah. I know I belong to one of those. So, yeah. But it's interesting to me that, you know, we learned about George, and, you know, George survived this whole thing. He's 95 years old now, as you mentioned. What did he do when he got out of the service? Did he get right out and just continue on with his life, or did he have any problems?
Well, I write about in the book, and I thought this was fascinating because I'm following two characters in the book, him and Draper Kaufman, as well as others, Squeaky Anderson and Kelly Turner and Ernie Pyle. But George met Draper Kaufman on the boat ride home from Japan. Draper said, if you're interested in applying to Annapolis, come up to my stateroom. And George thought, why not? He didn't have really a plan for what he was going to do after the Navy. He worked a lot of factory jobs and didn't really want to go back to that. So applied with Draper, met him, talked to him, interviewed, and got a what's called a fleet commission to go to Annapolis. Draper gave him leave to go home, take some tests because he needed a little more, a refresh on school. He's only 17 years old. While he was home, he started fainting, had fainting spells. And they sent him to a naval hospital, really couldn't get to the bottom of it. Today, we know that that's associated with PTSD and the emotional stress of coming off what he had, and body just shuts down. And so he was discharged from the Navy, went to college for a couple of years, met his wife, and wanted to get back working, been working since he was a little kid. And he became very successful in the food business with Duffy Mott, started his own company, retired in the 60s, and never really talked about the war for decades after. And I think that was a combination of not wanting to recall these memories. But also, they were sworn to secrecy. For a lot of these UDT guys, they didn't know if they could talk about their experiences. And a lot of people didn't and still don't know what the UDT was. They say, is that like the Marines or the Navy? So he finally told his story to the World War II Museum, which is where I found it, and shared it with me, of course.
What happened with Draper Kaufman?
Draper went on to fulfill his childhood dream of commanding destroyers, and he stayed on the leading edge of warfare, and that he was in the Bikini Atoll testing the waters during the atomic bomb blast. I read a little bit about his interests in the atomic bomb, and he ended up the dean of Annapolis, running Annapolis, and was early in integrating the school and a champion for some of the first black officers, and passed away in the 70s of a heart attack.
Well, I just think this is a great story, Andrew, and I strongly encourage our audience out there to go out and get this book. It's on sale starting on Tuesday, 23rd of August. And so are you thinking of expanding into any more things about frogmen?
That's a good question. I have found some interesting tales that I might like to write about, but might also want to go off in a totally different direction and think of something else.
Well, I appreciate you being on the program, and I want to thank you so very much for joining us here on Veterans Radio today. Thank you very much, Andrew. For more information about Andrew, you can go right to his own website. It's andrewdubbins.com, D-U-B-B-I-N-S, correct?
Correct. And thanks for having me on. I enjoyed the conversation.
Good. Thank you. All right. Well, we're coming up to the end of the hour again. And we want to thank everybody for listening to today's program. And I want to remind you again of our sponsors. That would be Legal Help for Veterans, National Veteran Business Development Council, and the American Mortgage. And I just, these types of stories that we've been doing the last couple of weeks have been very personal to me. As you all know, and as I just mentioned today, my dad had been in World War II and hadn't talked about these things at all. And so I've gotten more interested and I've been able to find out more. So if you have somebody that was in World War II and if they're still around, get their stories, find out what it is. See if you can get them to talk about it, whatever it takes to get these things. If we don't tell their stories, then they'll be forgotten, and never want them to be forgotten. And that's our goal here at Veterans Radio. And it's so many other programs now that are out there. I take it as a good sign that there are so many other programs out there that are telling about veteran stories today. And I want you all to listen in. So next week is going to be our benefits program. And we're going to be talking about the new PACT Act that was recently passed that is going to affect the Iraq-Afghanistan veterans as far as the burn pits are concerned. It's also going to add some more information for those Vietnam veterans that were exposed to Agent Orange. They've added another presumptive condition there with a high blood pressure. It seems like all of us have high blood pressure, but we'll see how that goes. And so we're going to try and fill in all the details in there. So if you have any questions, make sure you stick around next Sunday and you can give us a call live on the program. The last thing, again, I wanted to mention was, of course, is our fundraiser coming up on September 25th. That is going to be Radio on the River. We're going to have storytellers. We're going to have refreshments. We're going to have giveaways. We're going to have auctions, all kinds of different things for you. So we encourage you to go to veteransradio.net and click on the banner that says Radio on the River. And so we're very excited to be able to continue telling the story of America's veterans, all generations, men, women, doesn't make any difference. If you have any stories that you want us to tell, just send me an email. It's dale@veteransradio.net. We'll get in touch with you and see if we can get that program on the air. So we're going to go out early, a little bit early. I think we've got just a couple of seconds to go. So I'm going to say thank you very much for listening to Veterans Radio. This is Dale Thronberry. Until next week, you are dismissed.